Disc 4.
We must. We have had such a jolly good time. How about another bottle around? Jolly good idea, said Harris. This is mine, said Bill, or we don't drink it. I wish you'd let me pay for it. It does give me pleasure, you know. This is going to give me pleasure, Bill said. The innkeeper brought in the fourth bottle. We had kept the same glasses. Harris lifted his glass. I say, you know, this does utilize well. Bill slapped him on the back. Good old Harris. I say, you know, my name isn't really Harris. It's Wilson Harris. All one name with a hyphen, you know. Good old Wilson Harris, Bill said. We call you Harris because we're so fond of you. I say, Barnes, you don't know what this all means to me. Come on and utilize another glass, I said. Barnes, really, Barnes, you can't know, that's all. Drink up, Harris. We walked back down the road from Roncesvalles with Harris between us. We had lunch at the inn, and Harris went with us to the bus. He gave us his card with his address in London and his club and his business address, and as we got on the bus he handed us each an envelope. I opened mine, and there were a dozen flies in it. Harris had tied them himself. He tied all his own flies. I say, Harris, I began. No, no, he said. He was climbing down from the bus. They're not first-rate flies at all. I only thought if you fished them some time, it might remind you of what a good time we had. The bus started. Harris stood in front of the post office. He waved. As we started along the road, he turned and walked back toward the inn. Say, wasn't that Harris nice? Bill said. I think he really did have a good time.
Harris? You bet he did.
I wish he'd come into Pamplona. He wanted to fish. Yes, you couldn't tell how English would mix with each other anyway. I suppose not. We got into Pamplona late in the afternoon, and the bus stopped in front of the Hotel Montoya. Out in the plaza, they were stringing electric light wires to light the plaza for the fiesta. A few kids came up when the bus stopped, and a customs officer for the town made all the people getting down from the bus open their bundles on the sidewalk. We went into the hotel, and on the stairs I met Montoya. He shook hands with us, smiling in his embarrassed way.
Your friends are here, he said.
Mr. Campbell?
Yes, Mr. Cohn and Mr. Campbell and Lady Ashley.
He smiled as though there was something I would hear about.
When did they get in? Yesterday. I've saved you the rooms you had.
Oh, that's fine. Did you give Mr. Campbell the room on the plaza?
Yes, all the rooms we looked at.
Where are our friends now?
I think they went to the Pelota.
And how about the bulls? Montoya smiled.
Tonight, he said. Tonight at 7 o'clock. They bring in the BR bulls, and tomorrow come the Miuras. Do you all go down?
Oh, yes. They've never seen a desencajonada. Montoya put his hand on my shoulder.
I'll see you there.
He smiled again.
He always smiled as though bullfighting were a very special secret between the two of us, a rather shocking but really very deep secret that we knew about.
He always smiled as though there was something lewd about the secret to outsiders, but that it was something that we understood. It would not do to expose it to people who would not understand.
Your friend, is he aficionado too?
Montoya smiled at Bill.
Yes, he came all the way from New York to see the San Fermines.
Yes?
Montoya politely disbelieved.
But he's not aficionado like you.
He put his hand on my shoulder again embarrassedly.
Yes, I said, he's a real aficionado.
But he's not aficionado like you are.
Aficion means passion. An aficionado is one who is passionate about the bullfights. All the good bullfighters stayed at Montoya's hotel. That is, those with aficion stayed there. The commercial bullfighters stayed once, perhaps, and then did not come back. The good ones came each year.
In Montoya's room there were photographs. The photographs were dedicated to Juanito Montoya, or to his sister. The photographs of bullfighters Montoya had really believed in were framed. Photographs of bullfighters who had been without afición, Montoya kept in a drawer of his desk. They often had the most flattering inscriptions, but they did not mean anything. One day Montoya took them all out and dropped them in the wastebasket. He did not want them around. We often talked about bulls and bullfighters. I had stopped at the Montoya for several years. We never talked very long at a time. It was simply the pleasure of discovering what we each felt. Men would come in from distant towns and before they left Pamplona stop and talk for a few minutes with Montoya about bulls. These men were aficionados. Those who were aficionados could always get rooms even when the hotel was full. Montoya introduced me to some of them. They were always very polite at first, and it amused them very much that I should be an American. Somehow it was taken for granted that an American could not have afición. He might simulate it or confuse it with excitement, but he could not really have it. When they saw that I had afición, and there was no password, no set questions that could bring it out, rather it was a sort of oral spiritual examination, with the questions always a little on the defensive and never apparent. There was this same embarrassed putting the hand on the shoulder, or a buen hombre. But nearly always there was the actual touching. It seemed as though they wanted to touch you to make it certain. Montoya could forgive anything of a bullfighter who had afición. He could forgive attacks of nerves, panic, bad unexplainable actions, all sorts of lapses. For one who had afición, he could forgive anything. At once he forgave me all my friends. Without his ever saying anything, there was simply a little something shameful between us, like the spilling open of the horses in bullfighting. Bill had gone upstairs as we came in, and I found him washing and changing in his room. "Well," he said, "talk a lot of Spanish?" He was telling me about the bulls coming in tonight. "Let's find the gang and go down." "All right. They'll probably be at the cafe. Have you got tickets?" "Yes, I got them for all the unloadings." "What's it like?" He was pulling his cheek before the glass, looking to see if there were unshaved patches under the line of the jaw. "It's pretty good," I said. "They let the bulls out of the cages one at a time, and they have steers in the corral to receive them and keep them from fighting, and the bulls tear in at the steers, and the steers run around like old maids trying to quiet them down."
"Do they ever gore the steers?"
"Sure. Sometimes they go right after them and kill them."
"Can't the steers do anything?"
"No. They're trying to make friends."
"What do they have them in for?"
"To quiet down the bulls and keep them from breaking their horns against the stone walls or goring each other."
"Must be swell being a steer."
We went down the stairs and out of the door and walked across the square toward the Café Iruña. There were two lonely-looking ticket houses standing in the square, their windows marked Sol, Sol y Sombra, and Sombra, were shut. They would not open until the day before the fiesta. Across the square, the white wicker tables and chairs of the Iruña extended out beyond the arcade to the edge of the street. I looked for Brett and Mike at the tables. There they were, Brett and Mike and Robert Cohn. Brett was wearing a Basque beret. So was Mike. Robert Cohn was bareheaded and wearing his spectacles. Brett saw us coming and waved. Her eyes crinkled up as we came up to the table. "Hello, you chaps," she called. Brett was happy. Mike had a way of getting an intensity of feeling into shaking hands. Robert Cohn shook hands because we were back.
"Where the hell have you been?" I asked.
"I brought them up here," Cohn said.
"What rot," Brett said.
"We'd have gotten here earlier if you hadn't come."
"You'd never have gotten here."
"What rot? You chaps are brown. Look at Bill."
"Did you get good fishing?" Mike asked.
"We wanted to join you."
"It wasn't bad. We missed you."
"I wanted to come," Cohn said, "but I thought I ought to bring them."
"You bring us? What rot?"
"Was it really good?" Mike asked. "Did you take many?"
"Some days we took a dozen apiece. There was an Englishman up there."
"Named Harris," Bill said. "Ever know him, Mike? He was in the war, too."
"Fortunate fellow," Mike said. "What times we had.
How I wish those days were back."
"Don't be an ass."
Were you in the war, Mike? Cohn asked.
Was I not?
He was a very distinguished soldier, Brett said. Tell them about the time your horse bolted down Piccadilly.
I'll not. I've told that 4 times.
You never told me, Robert Cohn said.
I'll not tell that story. It reflects discredit on me.
Tell them about your medals.
I'll not. That story reflects great discredit on me.
What story is that?
Rhett will tell you. She tells all the stories that reflect discredit on me.
Go on, tell it, Brett.
Should I? I'll tell it myself.
What medals have you got, Mike?
I haven't got any medals.
You must have some.
Oh, I suppose I've the usual medals, but I never sent in for them. One time there was this whopping big dinner, and the Prince of Wales was to be there, and the cards said medals will be worn. So naturally I had no medals, and I stopped at my tailor's, and he was impressed by the invitation, and I thought, that's a good piece of business, and I said to him, you've got to fix me up with some medals. He said, what medals, sir? And I said, oh, any medals, just give me a few medals. So he said, what medals have you, sir? And I said, how should I know? Did he think I spent all my time reading the bloody Gazette? Just give me a good lot, pick them out yourself. So he got me some medals, you know, miniature medals, and he handed me the box, and I put it in my pocket and forgot it. Well, I went to the dinner, and it was the night they'd shot Henry Wilson. So the prince didn't come, and the king didn't come, and no one wore any medals, and all these coves were busy taking off their medals, and I had mine in my pocket.
He stopped for us to laugh.
Is that all?
That's all. Perhaps I didn't tell it right.
You didn't, said Brett, but no matter.
We were all laughing.
Ah, yes, said Mike. I know now. It was a damn dull dinner, and I couldn't stick it, so I left. Later on in the evening, I found the box in my pocket.
What's this? I said. Medals? Bloody military medals?
So I cut them all off their backing, you know, they put them on a strip, and gave them all around. Gave one to each girl, form of souvenir. They thought I was hell's own shakes of a soldier, giving away medals in a nightclub. Dashing fellow.
Tell the rest, Brett said.
Don't you think that was funny? Mike asked.
We were all laughing.
It was, I swear it was. Any rate, my tailor wrote me and wanted the medals back. Sent a man around. Kept on writing for months. Seems some chap had left them to be cleaned. Frightfully military cove. Set hell's own store by them.
Mike paused.
Rotten luck for the tailor, he said.
You don't mean it, Bill said.
I should think it would have been grand for the tailor.
Frightfully good tailor. Never believe it to see me now, Mike said. I used to pay him £100 a year just to keep him quiet, so he wouldn't send me any bills. Frightful blow to him when I went bankrupt. It was right after the medals. Gave his letters rather a bitter tone.
How did you go bankrupt? Bill asked.
2 ways, Mike said. Gradually and then suddenly.
What brought it on?
Friends, said Mike. I had a lot of friends, false friends. Then I had creditors, too. Probably had more creditors than anybody in England.
Tell them about in the court, Brett said.
I don't remember, Mike said. I was just a little tight.
Tight, Brett exclaimed. You were blind.
Extraordinary thing, Mike said. Met my former partner the other day. Offered to buy me a drink.
Tell them about your learned counsel, Brett said.
I will not, Mike said. My learned counsel was blind too.
I say, this is a gloomy subject. Are we going down and see those bulls unloaded or not?
Let's go down.
We called the waiter, paid, and started to walk through the town. I started off walking with Brett, but Robert Cohn came up and joined her on the other side. The three of us walked along, past the Ayuntamiento with the banners hung from the balcony, down past the market and down past the steep street that led to the bridge across the Arga. There were many people walking to go and see the bulls, and carriages drove down the hill and across the bridge, the drivers, the horses, and the whips rising above the walking people in the street. Across the bridge we turned up a road to the corrals. We passed a wine shop with a sign in the window. Good wine, 30 centimes a liter.
That's where we'll go when funds get low, Brett said.
The woman standing in the door of the wine shop looked at us as we passed. She called to someone in the house, and 3 girls came to the window and stared. They were staring at Brett.
At the gate of the corrals, two men took tickets from the people that went in. We went in through the gate. There were trees inside and a low stone house. At the far end was the stone wall of the corrals, with apertures in the stone that were like loopholes running all along the face of each corral. A ladder led up to the top of the wall, and people were climbing up the ladder and spreading down to stand on the walls that separated the two corrals. As we came up to the ladder, walking across the grass under the trees, we passed the big gray-painted cages with the bulls in them. There was one bull in each traveling box. They had come by train from a bull-breeding ranch in Castile, and had been unloaded off flat cars at the station and brought up here to be let out of their cages into the corrals. Each cage was stenciled with the name and the brand of the bull-breeder. We climbed up and found a place on the wall looking down into the corral. The stone walls were whitewashed, and there was straw on the ground, and wooden feed boxes and water troughs set against the wall. "Look up there," I said. Beyond the river rose the plateau of the town. All along the old walls and ramparts people were standing. The three lines of fortifications made three black lines of people. Above the walls there were heads in the windows of the houses. At the far end of the plateau, boys had climbed into the trees. "They must think something is going to happen," Brett said. "They want to see the bulls." Mike and Bill were on the other wall across the pit of the corral. They waved to us. People who had come late were standing behind us, pressing against us when other people crowded them. "Why don't they start?" Robert Cohn asked. A single mule was hitched to one of the cages and dragged it up against the gate in the corral wall. The men shoved and lifted it with crowbars into position against the gate. Men were standing on the wall ready to pull up the gate of the corral and then the gate of the cage. At the other end of the corral, a gate opened and two steers came in, swaying their heads and trotting, their lean flanks swinging. They stood together at the far end, their heads toward the gate where the bull would enter. "They don't look happy," Brett said. The men on top of the wall leaned back and pulled up the door of the corral. Then they pulled up the door of the cage. I leaned way over the wall and tried to see into the cage. It was dark. Someone rapped on the cage with an iron bar. Inside, something seemed to explode. The bull, striking into the wood from side to side with his horns, made a great noise. Then I saw a dark muzzle and the shadow of horns, and then, with a clattering on the wood in the hollow box, the bull charged and came out into the corral, skidding with his forefeet in the straw as he stopped, his head up, the great hump of muscle on his neck swollen tight, his body muscles quivering as he looked up at the crowd on the stone walls. The two steers backed away against the wall, their heads sunken, their eyes watching the bull. The bull saw them and charged. A man shouted from behind one of the boxes and slapped his hat against the planks, and the bull, before he reached the steer, turned, gathered himself, and charged where the man had been, trying to reach him behind the planks with a half-dozen quick, searching drives with the right horn. "My God, isn't he beautiful?" Brett said. We were looking right down on him. "Look how he knows how to use his horns," I said. "He's got a left and a right, just like a boxer." "Not really. You watch. It goes too fast." "Wait. There'll be another one in a minute." They had backed up another cage into the entrance. In the far corner, a man, from behind one of the plank shelters, attracted the bull, and while the bull was facing away, the gate was pulled up and a second bull came out into the corral. He charged straight for the steers, and two men ran out from behind the planks and shouted to turn him. He did not change his direction, and the men shouted, "Ha! Ha! Toro!" and waved their arms. The two steers turned sideways to take the shock, and the bull drove into one of the steers. "Don't look," I said to Brett. She was watching, fascinated. "Fine," I said, "if it doesn't buck you."
"I saw it," she said. "I saw him shift from his left to his right horn."
"Damn good." The steer was down now, his neck stretched out, his head twisted. He lay the way he had fallen. Suddenly the bull left off and made for the other steer, which had been standing at the far end, his head swinging, watching it all. The steer ran awkwardly, and the bull caught him, hooked him lightly in the flank, and then turned away and looked up at the crowd on the walls, his crest of muscle rising. The steer came up to him and made as though to nose at him, and the bull hooked perfunctorily. The next time he nosed at the steer, and then the two of them trotted over to the other bull. When the next bull came out, all three, the two bulls and the steer, stood together, their heads side by side, their horns against the newcomer. In a few minutes the steer picked the new bull up, quieted him down, and made him one of the herd. When the last two bulls had been unloaded, the herd were all together. The steer who had been gored had gotten to his feet and stood against the stone wall. None of the bulls came near him, and he did not attempt to join the herd. We climbed down from the wall with the crowd, and had a last look at the bulls through the loopholes in the wall of the corral. They were all quiet now, their heads down. We got a carriage outside and rode up to the cafe. Mike and Bill came in half an hour later. They had stopped on the way for several drinks. We were sitting in the cafe.
"That's an extraordinary business," Brett said.
"Will those last ones fight as well as the first?" Robert Cohn asked. "They seemed to quiet down awfully fast."
"They all know each other," I said. "They're only dangerous when they're alone, or only two or three of them together."
"What do you mean, dangerous?" Bill said. "They all look dangerous to me."
"They only want to kill when they're alone. Of course, if you went in there, you'd probably detach one of them from the herd, and he'd be dangerous."
"That's too complicated," Bill said. "Don't you ever detach me from the herd, Mike."
"I say," Mike said, "they were fine bulls, weren't they? Did you see their horns?"
"Did I not?" said Brett. "I had no idea what they were like."
"Did you see the one hit that steer?" Mike asked. "That was extraordinary."
"It's no life being a steer," Robert Cohn said.
"Don't you think so?" Mike said. "I would have thought you'd loved being a steer, Robert."
"What do you mean, Mike?"
"They lead such a quiet life. They never say anything, and they're always hanging about so."
We were embarrassed. Bill laughed. Robert Cohn was angry. Mike went on talking.
"I should think you'd love it. You'd never have to say a word. Come on, Robert, do say something. Don't just sit there."
"I said something, Mike. Don't you remember, about the steers?"
"Oh, say something more. Say something funny. Can't you see we're all having a good time here?"
"Come off it, Michael. You're drunk," Brett said.
"I'm not drunk. I'm quite serious. Is Robert Cohn going to follow Brett around like a steer all the time?"
"Shut up, Michael. Try and show a little breeding."
"Breeding be damned. Who has any breeding anyway except the bulls? Aren't the bulls lovely? Don't you like them, Bill?" "Why don't you say something, Robert? Don't sit there looking like a bloody funeral. What if Brett did sleep with you? She slept with lots of better people than you."
"Shut up," Cohn said. He stood up.
"Shut up, Mike."
"Oh, don't stand up and act as though you were going to hit me. That won't make any difference to me. Tell me, Robert, why do you follow Brett around like a poor bloody steer? Don't you know you're not wanted?"
"I know when I'm not wanted."
"Why don't you know when you're not wanted?"
"You came down to San Sebastian, where you weren't wanted, and followed Brett around like a bloody steer. Do you think that's right?"
"Shut up, you're drunk."
"Perhaps I am drunk. Why aren't you drunk? Why don't you ever get drunk, Robert? You know you didn't have a good time at San Sebastian because none of our friends would invite you on any of the parties. You can't blame them, hardly, can you? I asked them to. They wouldn't do it. You can't blame them now, can you? Now answer me. Can you blame them?"
"Go to hell, Mike."
"I can't blame them. Can you blame them? Why do you follow Brett around? Haven't you any manners? How do you think it makes me feel?"
"You're a splendid one to talk about manners," Brett said. "You've such lovely manners."
"Come on, Robert," Bill said. "What do you follow her around for?"
Bill stood up and took hold of Cohn.
"Don't go," Mike said. "Robert Cohn's going to buy a drink."
Bill went off with Cohn. Cohn's face was sallow. Mike went on talking. I sat and listened for a while. Brett looked disgusted.
"I say, Michael, you might not be such a bloody ass," she interrupted. "I'm not saying he's not right, you know." She turned to me.
The emotion left Mike's voice. We were all friends together.
"I'm not so damned drunk as I sounded," he said.
"I know you're not," Brett said.
"We're none of us sober," I said.
"I didn't say anything I didn't mean."
"But you put it so badly," Brett laughed.
"He was an ass, though. He came down to San Sebastian where he damn well wasn't wanted. He hung around Brett and just looked at her. It made me damn well sick."
"He did behave very badly," Brett said. "Mark you, Brett's had affairs with men before. She tells me all about everything. She gave me this chap Cohn's letters to read. I wouldn't read them."
"Damned noble of you."
No, listen, Jake. Brett's gone off with men, but they weren't ever Jews, and they didn't come and hang about afterward.
Damned good chaps, Brett said. It's all rot to talk about it. Michael and I understand each other.
She gave me Robert Cohn's letters. I wouldn't read them.
You wouldn't read any letters, darling. You wouldn't read mine.
I can't read letters, Mike said. Funny, isn't it?
You can't read anything.
No, you're wrong there. I read quite a bit. I read when I'm at home.
You'll be writing next, Brett said. Come on, Michael, do buck up. You've got to go through with this thing now. He's here. Don't spoil the fiesta.
Well, let him behave, then.
He'll behave. I'll tell him.
You tell him, Jake. Tell him either he must behave or get out.
Yes, I said it would be nice for me to tell him.
Look, Brett, tell Jake what Robert calls you. That is perfect, you know.
Oh, no, I can't.
Go on, we're all friends. Aren't we all friends, Jake?
I can't tell him. It's too ridiculous.
I'll tell him.
You won't, Michael. Don't be an ass.
He calls her Circe, Mike said. He claims she turns men into swine.
Damn good. I wish I were one of these literary chaps.
He'd be good, you know, Brett said. He writes a good letter.
I know, he said. He wrote me from San Sebastian.
That was nothing, Brett said. He can write a damned amusing letter.
She made me write that. She was supposed to be ill.
I damned well was, too.
Come on, I said. We must go in and eat.
How should I meet Cohn? Mike said.
Just act as though nothing had happened.
It's quite all right with me, Mike said. I'm not embarrassed.
If he says anything, just say you were tight.
Quite. The funny thing is, I think I was tight.
Come on, Brett said. Are these poisonous things paid for? I must bathe before dinner.
We walked across the square. It was dark, and all around the square were the lights from the cafes under the arcades. We walked across the gravel under the trees to the hotel.
They went upstairs, and I stopped to speak with Montoya.
Well, how did you like the bulls? He asked.
Good. They were nice bulls.
They're all right, Montoya shook his head. But they're not too good.
What didn't you like about them?
I don't know. They just didn't give me the feeling that they were so good.
I know what you mean.
They're all right.
Yes, they're all right.
How did your friends like them?
Fine.
Good, Montoya said.
I went upstairs. Bill was in his room standing on the balcony looking out at the square. I stood beside him.
Where's Cohn?
Upstairs in his room.
How does he feel?
Well, like hell, naturally. Mike was awful. He's terrible when he's tight.
He wasn't so tight.
The hell he wasn't. I know what we had before we came to the cafe.
He sobered up afterward.
Good. He was terrible. I don't like Cohn, God knows, and I think it was a silly trick for him to go down to San Sebastian, but nobody has any business to talk like Mike.
How'd you like the bulls?
Grand. It's grand the way they bring them out.
Tomorrow come the Miuras.
When does the fiesta start?
Day after tomorrow.
We've got to keep Mike from getting so tight. That kind of stuff is terrible.
We'd better get cleaned up for supper.
Yes, that'll be a pleasant meal.
Won't it?
As a matter of fact, supper was a pleasant meal. Brett wore a black sleeveless evening dress. She looked quite beautiful. Mike acted as though nothing had happened. I had to go up and bring Robert Cohn down. He was reserved and formal, and his face was still taut and sallow, but he cheered up finally. He could not stop looking at Brett. It seemed to make him happy. It must have been pleasant for him to see her looking so lovely, and know he had been away with her and that everyone knew it. They could not take that away from him. Bill was very funny. So was Michael. They were good together. It was like certain dinners I remember from the war. There was much wine, an ignored tension, and a feeling of things coming that you could not prevent happening. Under the wine, I lost the disgusted feeling and was happy. It seemed they were all such nice people. Chapter 14. I do not know what time I got to bed. I remember undressing, putting on a bathrobe, and standing out on the balcony. I knew I was quite drunk, and when I came in, I put on the light over the head of the bed and started to read. I was reading a book by Turgenev. Probably I read the same two pages over several times. It was one of the stories in a sportsman's sketches. I had read it before, but it seemed quite new. The country became very clear, and the feeling of pressure in my head seemed to loosen. I was very drunk, and I did not want to shut my eyes because the room would go round and round. If I kept on reading, that feeling would pass. I heard Brett and Robert Cohn come up the stairs. Cohn said good night outside the door and went on up to his room. I heard Brett go into the room next door. Mike was already in bed. He had come in with me an hour before. He woke as she came in, and they talked together. I heard them laugh. I turned off the light and tried to go to sleep. It was not necessary to read anymore. I could shut my eyes without getting the wheeling sensation, but I could not sleep. There is no reason why, because it is dark, you should look at things differently from when it is light. The hell there isn't. I figured that all out once, and for 6 months I never slept with the electric light off. That was another bright idea. The hell with women, anyway. The hell with you, Brett Ashley. Women made such swell friends. Awfully swell. In the first place, you had to be in love with the woman to have a basis of friendship. I had been having Brett for a friend. I had not been thinking about her side of it. I had been getting something for nothing. That only delayed the presentation of the bill. The bill always came. That was one of the swell things you could count on. I thought I'd paid for everything. Not like the woman pays and pays and pays. No idea of retribution or punishment, just exchange of values. You gave up something and got something else. Or you worked for something. You paid some way for everything that was any good. I paid my way into enough things that I liked so that I had a good time. Either you paid by learning about them, or by experience, or by taking chances, or by money. Enjoying living was learning to get your money's worth and knowing when you had it. You could get your money's worth. The world was a good place to buy in. It seemed like a fine philosophy. In 5 years, I thought, it will seem just as silly as all the other fine philosophies I've had. Perhaps that wasn't true, though. Perhaps as you went along, you did learn something. I did not care what it was all about. All I wanted to know was how to live in it. Maybe if you found out how to live in it, you learned from that what it was all about. I wished Mike would not behave so terribly to Cohn, though. Mike was a bad drunk. Brett was a good drunk. Bill was a good drunk. Cohn was never drunk. Mike was unpleasant after he passed a certain point. I liked to see him hurt Cohn. I wished he would not do it, though, because afterward it made me disgusted at myself. That was morality. Things that made you disgusted afterward. No, that must be immorality. Well, that was a large statement. What a lot of bilge I could think up at night. What rot, I could hear Brett say. What rot? When you were with English, you got into the habit of using English expressions in your thinking. The English spoken language, the upper classes anyway, must have fewer words than the Eskimo. Of course, I didn't know anything about the Eskimo. Maybe the Eskimo was a fine language. Say, the Cherokee. I didn't know anything about the Cherokee, either. The English talked with inflected phrases. One phrase to mean everything. I liked them, though. I liked the way they talked. Take Harris. Still, Harris was not the upper classes. I turned on the light again and read. I read the Turgenev. I knew that now, reading it in the oversensitized state of my mind after much too much brandy, I would remember it somewhere, and afterward it would seem as though it had really happened to me. I would always have it. That was another good thing you paid for and then had. Sometime along toward daylight, I went to sleep. The next 2 days in Pamplona were quiet, and there were no more rows. The town was getting ready for the fiesta. Workmen put up the gateposts that were to shut off the side streets when the bulls were released from the corrals and came running through the streets in the morning on their way to the ring. The workmen dug holes and fitted in the timbers, each timber numbered for its regular place. Out on the plateau beyond the town, employees of the bull ring exercised picador horses, galloping them stiff-legged on the hard, sun-baked fields behind the bull ring. The big gate of the bull ring was open, and inside the amphitheater was being swept. The ring was rolled and sprinkled, and carpenters replaced weakened or cracked planks in the barrera. Standing at the edge of the smooth rolled sand, you could look up in the empty stands and see old women sweeping out the boxes. Outside, the fence that led from the last street of the town to the entrance of the bull ring was already in place and made a long pen. The crowd would come running down with the bulls behind them on the morning of the day of the first bullfight. Out across the plain, where the horse and cattle fair would be, some gypsies had camped under the trees. The wine and aguardiente sellers were putting up their booths. One booth advertised Anis del Toro. The cloth sign hung against the planks in the hot sun. In the big square that was the center of the town, there was no change yet. We sat in the white wicker chairs on the terrace of the cafe and watched the motor buses come in and unload peasants from the country coming into the market. And we watched the buses fill up and start out with peasants sitting with their saddlebags full of the things they had bought in the town. The tall gray motor buses were the only life of the square, except for the pigeons and the man with a hose who sprinkled the graveled square and watered the streets. In the evening was the paseo. For an hour after dinner, everyone, all the good-looking girls, the officers from the garrison, all the fashionable people of the town, walked in the street on one side of the square while the cafe tables filled with the regular after-dinner crowd. During the morning, I usually sat in the cafe and read the Madrid papers and then walked in the town or out into the country. Sometimes Bill went along, sometimes he wrote in his room. Robert Cohn spent the mornings studying Spanish or trying to get a shave at the barber shop. Brett and Mike never got up until noon. We all had a vermouth at the cafe. It was a quiet life and no one was drunk. I went to church a couple of times, once with Brett. She said she wanted to hear me go to confession, but I told her that not only was it impossible, but it was not as interesting as it sounded. And besides, it would be in a language she did not know. We met Cohn as we came out of church, and although it was obvious he had followed us, yet he was very pleasant and nice, and we all three went for a walk out to the gypsy camp, and Brett had her fortune told. It was a good morning. There were high white clouds above the mountains. It had rained a little in the night, and it was fresh and cool on the plateau, and there was a wonderful view. We all felt good, and we felt healthy, and I felt quite friendly to Cohn. You could not be upset about anything on a day like that. That was the last day before the fiesta. Chapter 15. At noon of Sunday, the 6th of July, the fiesta exploded. There is no other way to describe it. People had been coming in all day from the country, but they were assimilated in the town, and you did not notice them. The square was as quiet in the hot sun as on any other day. The peasants were in the outlying wine shops. There they were drinking, getting ready for the fiesta. They had come in so recently from the plains and the hills that it was necessary that they make their shifting in values gradually. They could not start in paying cafe prices. They got their money's worth in the wine shops. Money still had a definite value in hours worked and bushels of grain sold. Late in the fiesta, it would not matter what they paid nor where they bought. Now, on the day of the starting of the fiesta of San Fermín, they had been in the wine shops of the narrow streets of the town since early morning. Going down the streets in the morning on the way to Mass in the cathedral, I heard them singing through the open doors of the shops. They were warming up. There were many people at the 11 o'clock Mass. San Fermín is also a religious festival. I walked down the hill from the cathedral and up the street to the cafe in the square. It was a little before noon. Robert Cohn and Bill were sitting at one of the tables. The marble-topped tables and the white wicker chairs were gone. They were replaced by cast-iron tables and severe folding chairs. The cafe was like a battleship stripped for action. Today the waiters did not leave you alone all morning to read without asking if you wanted to order something. A waiter came up as soon as I sat down. "What are you drinking?" I asked Bill and Robert. "Sherry," Cohn said. "Jerez," I said to the waiter. Before the waiter brought the sherry, the rocket that announced the fiesta went up in the square. It burst and there was a great ball of smoke high up above the Teatro Gallare, across on the other side of the plaza. The ball of smoke hung in the sky like a shrapnel burst, and as I watched, another rocket came up to it, trickling smoke in the bright sunlight. I saw the bright flash as it burst, and another little cloud of smoke appeared. By the time the second rocket had burst, there were so many people in the arcade that had been empty a minute before that the waiter, holding the bottle high up over his head, could hardly get through the crowd to our table. People were coming into the square from all sides, and down the street we heard the pipes and the fifes and the drums coming. They were playing the Real Real music, the pipes shrill and the drums pounding, and behind them came the men and boys dancing. When the fifers stopped, they all crouched down in the street, and when the reed fifes and the fifes shrilled and the flat, dry, hollow drums tapped it out again, they all went up in the air dancing. In the crowd, you saw only the heads and shoulders of the dancers going up and down. In the square, a man, bent over, was playing on a reed pipe, and a crowd of children were following him, shouting and pulling at his clothes. He came out of the square, the children following him, and piped them past the cafe and down a side street. We saw his blank, pockmarked face as he went by, piping, the children close behind him, shouting and pulling at him.
"He must be the village idiot," Bill said. "My God, look at that!"
Down the street came dancers. The street was solid with dancers, all men. They were all dancing in time behind their own fifers and drummers. They were a club of some sort and all wore workmen's blue smocks and red handkerchiefs around their necks and carried a great banner on two poles. The banner danced up and down with them as they came down surrounded by the crowd. "Hooray for wine! Hooray for the foreigners!" was painted on the banner.
"Where are the foreigners?" Robert Cohn asked.
"Where are the foreigners?" Bill said. All the time rockets were going up. The cafe tables were all full now. The square was emptying of people, and the crowd was filling the cafes.
"Where's Brett and Mike?" Bill asked.
"I'll go and get them," Cohn said.
"Bring them here."
The fiesta was really started. It kept up day and night for 7 days. The dancing kept up, the drinking kept up, the noise went on. The things that happened could only have happened during a fiesta. Everything became quite unreal, finally, and it seemed as though nothing could have any consequences. It seemed out of place to think of consequences during the fiesta. All during the fiesta you had the feeling, even when it was quiet, that you had to shout any remark to make it heard. It was the same feeling about any action. It was a fiesta, and it went on for 7 days. That afternoon was the big religious procession. San Fermin was translated from one church to another. In the procession were all the dignitaries, civil and religious. We could not see them because the crowd was too great. Ahead of the formal procession and behind it danced the Real Real dancers. There was one mass of yellow shirts dancing up and down in the crowd. All we could see of the procession through the closely pressed people that crowded all the side streets and curbs were the great giants, cigar store Indians, 30 feet high, Moors, a king and queen, whirling and waltzing solemnly to the Real Real. We started inside, and there was a smell of incense and people filing back into the church, but Brett was stopped just inside the door because she had no hat, so we went out again and along the street that ran back from the chapel into town. The street was lined on both sides with people keeping their place at the curb for the return of the procession. Some dancers formed a circle around Brett and started to dance. They wore big wreaths of white garlics around their necks. They took Bill and me by the arms and put us in the circle. Bill started to dance, too. They were all chanting. Brett wanted to dance, but they did not want her to. They wanted her as an image to dance around. When the song ended with a sharp, "Riau, riau," they rushed us into a wine shop. We stood at the counter. They had Brett seated on a wine cask. It was dark in the wine shop and full of men singing, hard-voiced singing. Back of the counter, they drew the wine from casks. I put down money for the wine, but one of the men picked it up and put it back in my pocket.
"I want a leather wine bottle," Bill said.
"There's a place down the street," I said. "I'll go get a couple." The dancers did not want me to go out. Three of them were sitting on the high wine cask beside Brett, teaching her to drink out of the wineskins. They had hung a wreath of garlics around her neck. Someone insisted on giving her a glass. Somebody was teaching Bill a song, singing it into his ear, beating time on Bill's back. I explained to them that I would be back. Outside in the street, I went down the street looking for the shop that made leather wine bottles. The crowd was packed on the sidewalks, and many of the shops were shuttered, and I could not find it. I walked as far as the church, looking on both sides of the street. Then I asked a man, and he took me by the arm and led me to it. The shutters were up, but the door was open. Inside it smelled of fresh tanned leather and hot tar. A man was stenciling completed wineskins. They hung from the roof in bunches. He took one down, blew it up, screwed the nozzle tight, and then jumped on it.
"See? It doesn't leak.
I want another one, too, a big one." He took down a big one that would hold a gallon or more from the roof. He blew it up, his cheeks puffing ahead of the wineskin, and stood on the bota, holding onto a chair.
"What are you going to do, sell them in Bayonne?"
"No, drink out of them." He slapped me on the back.
"Good man! 8 pesetas for the two, the lowest price."
The man who was stenciling the new ones and tossing them into a pile stopped.
It's true, he said. 8 pesetas is cheap. I paid and went out and along the street back to the wine shop. It was darker than ever inside and very crowded. I did not see Brett and Bill, and someone said they were in the back room. At the counter, the girl filled the 2 wineskins for me. One held 2 liters, the other held 5 liters. Filling them both cost 3 pesetas, 60 centimos. Someone at the counter that I had never seen before tried to pay for the wine, but I finally paid for it myself. The man who had wanted to pay then bought me a drink. He would not let me buy one in return, but said he would take a rinse of the mouth from the new wine bag. He tipped the big 5-liter bag up and squeezed it so the wine hissed against the back of his throat. All right, he said, and handed back the bag. In the back room, Brett and Bill were sitting on barrels, surrounded by the dancers. Everybody had his arms on everybody else's shoulders, and they were all singing. Mike was sitting at a table with several men in their shirt sleeves, eating from a bowl of tuna fish, chopped onions, and vinegar. They were all drinking wine and mopping up the oil and vinegar with pieces of bread.
"Hello, Jake!"
"Hello!" Mike called.
"Come here. I want you to meet my friends. We're all having an hors d'oeuvre."
I was introduced to the people at the table. They supplied their names to Mike and sent for a fork for me.
"Stop eating their dinner, Michael," Brett shouted from the wine barrels.
"I don't want to eat up your meal," I said when someone handed me a fork.
"Eat," he said. "What do you think it's here for?"
I unscrewed the nozzle of the big wine bottle and handed it around. Everyone took a drink, tipping the wineskin at arm's length. Outside, above the singing, we could hear the music of the procession going by.
"Isn't that the procession?" Mike asked.
"Nada," someone said. "It's nothing. Drink up. Lift the bottle."
"Where did they find you?" I asked Mike. "Someone brought me here," Mike said. "They said you were here."
"Where's Cone?"
"He's passed out," Brett called. "They've put him away somewhere."
"Where is he?"
"I don't know."
"How should we know?" Bill said. "I think he's dead."
"He's not dead," Mike said. "I know he's not dead. He's just passed out on Anise del Mono."
As he said Anise del Mono, one of the men at the table looked up, brought out a bottle from inside his smock, and handed it to me.
"No," I said, "no thanks." "Yes, yes, arriba, up with the bottle."
I took a drink. It tasted of licorice and warmed all the way. I could feel it warming in my stomach.
"Where the hell is Cone?"
"I don't know," Mike said. "I'll ask."
"Where is the drunken comrade?" he asked in Spanish.
"You want to see him?"
"Yes," I said.
"Not me," said Mike. "This gent." The Anise del Mono man wiped his mouth and stood up.
"Come on."
In a back room, Robert Cone was sleeping quietly on some wine casks. It was almost too dark to see his face. They had covered him with a coat, and another coat was folded under his head. Around his neck and on his chest was a big wreath of twisted garlics.
"Let him sleep," the man whispered. "He's all right."
2 hours later, Cone appeared. He came into the front room still with the wreath of garlics around his neck. The Spaniards shouted when he came in. Cone wiped his eyes and grinned.
"I must have been sleeping," he said.
"Oh, not at all," Brett said.
"You were only dead," Bill said.
"Aren't we going to go and have some supper?" Cone asked.
"Do you want to eat?"
"Yes, why not? I'm hungry."
"Eat those garlics, Robert," Mike said. "I say, do eat those garlics."
Cone stood there. His sleep had made him quite all right.
"Do let's go and eat," Brett said. "I must get a bath."
"Come on," Bill said. "Let's translate Brett to the hotel." We said goodbye to many people and shook hands with many people and went out. Outside it was dark.
"What time is it, you suppose?" Cone asked.
"It's tomorrow," Mike said. "You've been asleep 2 days."
"No," said Cone. "What time is it?"
"It's 10 o'clock.
"What a lot we've drunk."
"You mean what a lot we've drunk. You went to sleep." Going down the dark streets to the hotel, we saw the skyrockets going up in the square. Down the side streets that led to the square, we saw the square solid with people, those in the center all dancing. It was a big meal at the hotel. It was the first meal of the prices being doubled for the fiesta, and there were several new courses. After the dinner, we were out in the town. I remember resolving that I would stay up all night to watch the bulls go through the streets at 6 o'clock in the morning, and being so sleepy that I went to bed around 4 o'clock. The others stayed up. My own room was locked, and I could not find the key, so I went upstairs and slept on one of the beds in Cone's room. The fiesta was going on outside in the night, but I was too sleepy for it to keep me awake. When I woke, it was the sound of the rocket exploding that announced the release of the bulls from the corrals at the edge of town. They would race through the streets and out to the bull ring. I'd been sleeping heavily, and I woke feeling I was too late. I put on a coat of Cone's and went out on the balcony. Down below, the narrow street was empty. All the balconies were crowded with people. Suddenly a crowd came down the street. They were all running, packed close together. They passed along and up the street toward the bull ring, and behind them came more men running faster, and then some stragglers who were really running. Behind them was a little bare space, and then the bulls galloping, tossing their heads up and down. It all went out of sight around the corner. One man fell, rolled to the gutter, and lay quiet. But the bulls went right on and did not notice him. They were all running together. After they went out of sight, a great roar came from the bull ring. It kept on. Then finally the pop of the rocket that meant the bulls had gotten through the people in the ring and into the corrals. I went back in the room and got into bed. I'd been standing on the stone balcony in bare feet. I knew our crowd must have all been out at the bull ring. Back in bed, I went to sleep. Cone woke me when he came in. He started to undress and went over and closed the window because the people on the balcony of the house just across the street were looking in. "Did you see the show?" I asked. "Yes, we were all there." "Anybody get hurt?" "One of the bulls got into the crowd in the ring and tossed 6 or 8 people." "How did Brett like it?" "It was all so sudden there wasn't any time for it to bother anybody." "I wish I'd been up." "We didn't know where you were. We went to your room, but it was locked." "Where did you stay up?" "Well, we danced at some club." "I got sleepy," I said. "My gosh, I'm sleepy now," Cone said. "Doesn't this thing ever stop?" "Not for a week." Bill opened the door and put his head in.
"Where were you, Jake?"
"I saw them go through from the balcony. How was it?"
"Grand."
"Where are you going?"
"To sleep."
No one was up before noon. We ate at tables set out under the arcade. The town was full of people. We had to wait for a table. After lunch, we went over to the Urunia. It had filled up, and as the time for the bullfight came, it got fuller, and the tables were crowded closer. There was a close, crowded hum that came every day before the bullfight. The cafe did not make the same noise at any other time, no matter how crowded it was. This hum went on, and we were in it and a part of it. I had taken 6 seats for all the fights. 3 of them were barreras, the first row at the ringside, and 3 were sobrepuertos, seats with wooden backs, halfway up the amphitheater. Mike thought Brett had best sit high up for her first time, and Cone wanted to sit with them. Bill and I were going to sit in the barreras, and I gave the extra ticket to a waiter to sell. Bill said something to Cone about what to do and how to look, so he would not mind the horses. Bill had seen 1 season of bullfights. "I'm not worried about how I'll stand it. I'm only afraid I may be bored," Cone said.
"You think so?"
"Don't look at the horses after the bull hits them," I said to Brett. "Watch the charge and see the picador try and keep the bull off, but then don't look again until the horse is dead if it's been hit." "I'm a little nervy about it," Brett said. "I'm worried whether I'll be able to go through with it all right."
"You'll be all right. There's nothing but that horse part that will bother you, and they're only in for a few minutes with each bull. Just don't watch when it's bad."
"She'll be all right," Mike said. "I'll look after her."
"I don't think you'll be bored," Bill said.
"I'm going over to the hotel to get the glasses and the wineskin," I said. "See you back here. Don't get cockeyed."
"I'll come along," Bill said.
Brett smiled at us. We walked around through the arcade to avoid the heat of the square.
"That Cone gets me," Bill said. "He's got this Jewish superiority so strong that he thinks the only emotion he'll get out of the fight will be being bored."
"We'll watch him with the glasses," I said.
"Oh, to hell with him.
He spends a lot of time there.
I want him to stay there."
In the hotel on the stairs, we met Montoya.
Come on, said Montoya. Do you want to meet Pedro Romero?
Fine, Bill said. Let's go see him.
We followed Montoya up a flight and down the corridor. He's in room number 8, Montoya explained. He's getting dressed for the bullfight.
Montoya knocked on the door and opened it. It was a gloomy room with a little light coming in from the window on the narrow street. There were two beds separated by a monastic partition. The electric light was on. The boy stood very straight and unsmiling in his bullfighting clothes. His jacket hung over the back of a chair. They were just finishing winding his sash. His black hair shone under the electric light. He wore a white linen shirt, and the sword handler finished his sash and stood up and stepped back. Pedro Romero nodded, seeming very far away and dignified, when we shook hands. Montoya said something about what great aficionados we were, and that we wanted to wish him luck. Romero listened very seriously. Then he turned to me. He was the best-looking boy I've ever seen.
You go to the bullfight, he said in English.
You know English, I said, feeling like an idiot.
No, he answered, and smiled.
One of three men who had been sitting on the beds came up and asked us if we spoke French.
Would you like me to interpret for you? Is there anything you would like to ask Pedro Romero?
We thanked him. What was there that you would like to ask? The boy was 19 years old, alone except for his sword handler and the three hangers-on, and the bullfight was to commence in 20 minutes. We wished him mucha suerte, shook hands, and went out. He was standing, straight and handsome and altogether by himself, alone in the room with the hangers-on as we shut the door.
He's a fine boy, don't you think so? Montoya asked.
He's a good-looking kid, I said.
He looks like a torero, Montoya said. He has the type.
He's a fine boy.
We'll see how he is in the ring, Montoya said.
We found the big leather wine bottle leaning against the wall in my room, took it and the field glasses, locked the door, and went downstairs. It was a good bullfight. Bill and I were very excited about Pedro Romero. Montoya was sitting about 10 places away. After Romero had killed his first bull, Montoya caught my eye and nodded his head. This was a real one. There had not been a real one for a long time. Of the other two matadors, one was very fair and the other was passable, but there was no comparison with Romero, although neither of his bulls was much. Several times during the bullfight, I looked up at Mike and Brett and Cone with the glasses. They seemed to be all right. Brett did not look upset. All three were leaning forward on the concrete railing in front of them.
Let me take the glasses, Bill said.
Does Cone look bored? I asked.
That kike.
Outside the ring, after the bullfight was over, you could not move in the crowd. We could not make our way through, but had to be moved with the whole thing, slowly as a glacier, back to town. We had that disturbed emotional feeling that always comes after a bullfight, and the feeling of elation that comes after a good bullfight. The fiesta was going on, the drums pounded and the pipe music was shrill, and everywhere the flow of the crowd was broken by patches of dancers. The dancers were in a crowd, so you did not see the intricate play of the feet. All you saw was the head and shoulders going up and down, up and down. Finally, we got out of the crowd and made for the cafe. The waiter saved chairs for the others, and we each ordered an absinthe and watched the crowd in the square and the dancers.
What do you suppose that dance is? Bill asked.
It's a sort of jota.
They're not all the same, Bill said. They dance differently to all the different tunes.
It's swell dancing. In front of us, on a clear part of the street, a company of boys were dancing. The steps were very intricate, and their faces were intent and concentrated. They all looked down while they danced. Their rope-soled shoes tapped and spatted on the pavement. The toes touched, the heels touched, the balls of the feet touched. Then the music broke wildly, and the step was finished, and they were all dancing on up the street.
"Here come the gentry," Bill said.
They were crossing the street.
"Hello, men," I said. "Hello, gents," said Brett. "You saved our seats? How nice."
"I say," Mike said, "that Romero, what's his name, is somebody. Am I wrong?"
"Oh, isn't he lovely," Brett said, "and those green trousers."
Brett never took her eyes off them.
"I say, I must borrow your glasses tomorrow."
"How did it go?"
"Wonderfully, simply perfect. I say, it is a spectacle."
"How about the horses?"
"I couldn't help looking at them."
"She couldn't take her eyes off them," Mike said. "She's an extraordinary wench."
"They do have some rather awful things happen to them," Brett said. "I couldn't look away, though."
"Did you feel all right?"
"I didn't feel badly at all."
"Robert Cohn did," Mike put in. "You were quite green, Robert."
"The first horse did bother me," Cohn said.
"You weren't bored, were you?" asked Bill.
Cohn laughed.
"No, I wasn't bored. I wish you'd forgive me that."
"It's all right," Bill said, "so long as you weren't bored."
"He didn't look bored," Mike said. "I thought he was going to be sick."
"I never felt that bad. It was just for a minute."
"I thought he was going to be sick. You weren't bored, were you, Robert?"
"Let up on that, Mike. I said I was sorry I said it."
"He was, you know. He was positively green."
"Oh, shove it along, Michael."
"You mustn't ever get bored at your first bullfight, Robert," Mike said. "It might make such a mess."
"Oh, shove it along, Michael," Brett said.
"He said Brett was a sadist," Mike said. "Brett's not a sadist. She's just a lovely, healthy wench."
"Are you a sadist, Brett?" I asked.
"Hope not."
"He said Brett was a sadist just because she has a good, healthy stomach."
"Won't be healthy long."
Bill got Mike started on something else than Cohn. The waiter brought the absinthe glasses.
"Did you really like it?" Bill asked Cohn.
"No, I can't say I liked it. I think it's a wonderful show."
"Cad, yes, what a spectacle," Brett said.
"I wish they didn't have the horse part," Cohn said.
"They're not important," Bill said. "After a while, you never notice anything disgusting."
"It is a bit strong just at the start," Brett said. "There's a dreadful moment for me just when the bull starts for the horse."
"The bulls were fine," Cohn said.
"They were very good," Mike said. "I want to sit down below next time."
Brett drank from her glass of absinthe.
"She wants to see the bullfighters close by," Mike said.
"They are something," Brett said. "That Romero lad is just a child."
"He's a damn good-looking boy," I said. "When we were up in his room, I never saw a better-looking kid."
"How old do you suppose he is?"
19 or 20.
"Just imagine it."
The bullfight on the second day was much better than on the first. Brett sat between Mike and me at the Barrera, and Bill and Cohn went up above. Romero was the whole show. I do not think Brett saw any other bullfighter. No one else did either, except the hard-shelled technicians. It was all Romero. There were two other matadors, but they did not count. I sat beside Brett and explained to Brett what it was all about. I told her about watching the bull, not the horse, when the bulls charged the picadors, and got her to watching the picador place the point of his pick so that she saw what it was all about, so that it became more something that was going on with a definite end, and less of a spectacle with unexplained horrors. I had her watch how Romero took the bull away from a fallen horse with his cape, and how he held him with the cape and turned him smoothly and suavely, never wasting the bull. She saw how Romero avoided every brusque movement, and saved his bulls for the last when he wanted them, not winded and discomposed, but smoothly worn down. She saw how close Romero always worked to the bull, and I pointed out to her the tricks the other bullfighters used to make it look as though they were working closely. She saw why she liked Romero's cape work, and why she did not like the others. Romero never made any contortions. Always it was straight and pure and natural in line. The others twisted themselves like corkscrews, their elbows raised, and leaned against the flanks of the bull after his horns had passed to give a faked look of danger. Afterward, all that was faked turned bad and gave an unpleasant feeling.
This book is continued on Disc 5.